I have a very bad feeling that when this is all over, you're going to see a lot of environmental fees being charged to ships transiting the strait. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in this enterprise in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and an Atlantic contributor. Elliot, how are you and where are you?
Yeah, well, that's a question you periodically ask. I'm in one of my favorite places in the world, Basin Harbor, Vermont, on the shores of Lake Champlain, where we're about to have a conference, which actually you will be speaking at, and you have a very distinguished role. One of the you'll notice my vest here that says Fort Ticonderoga. So this morning, my wife and I went off and we visited that place, which is, by the way, particularly for anybody who really likes early American history, this is a place to go. They're fantastic. It's a very, very interesting piece of American military history. They have terrific living history programs and all that sort of thing. But as you know, one of the reasons why I like this area, Eric, is because not far from here, in October of 1776, Benedict Arnold, a much misunderstood man, conducted a brilliant rearguard action, one of his many contributions to American independence, which are undervalued. And at Fort Ticonderoga, they have actually an amazing collection and exhibits. And believe it or not, I saw that they had a lock of Benedict Arnold's hair. And it made my heart go pit-a-pat.
I'm sure it did. I will stipulate that as anybody who would like to read Conquered into Liberty about the Great Warpath, that he did play a heroic role in that particular episode. So,
good on him
before he betrayed his country, but never mind.
Fine. Picky.
Lots of jackassery. I mean, tons of jackassery to go around. I mean, I was thinking about, saying something about Peter Thiel trying to take up Argentine citizenship to go with his Maltese passport. And I think he also sought citizenship in New Zealand because apparently...
Oh, I'm sure. These guys all have bunkers in New Zealand. Yeah,
deeply afraid that, peasants with pitchforks are coming to get the tech bros. So...
I just want to say parenthetically, I think all these survivalist tech bros who think that they're going to ride out thermonuclear war and populist upheavals, the one thing that they always assume is that their security guards will stay loyal rather than shooting them in the head and stealing all their gold. But
yeah, there's
who am
that.
I to say?
They might want to interview Maduro in jail, see what he has to say about that. But I'll go with jackassery this week having failed to put Trump on a commemorative coin or a dollar, a silver dollar. His factota have now come up with the idea of creating a $250 bill, which I guess is a sign of the inflationary times in which we live, which would commemorate the 250th anniversary of the United States by putting Donald J. Trump's picture on the bill. There is law in the books that, dates back to, I believe, maybe even the 18th century, but at least the early 19th, that prohibits the face of any living person from being on U.S. currency. And of course, George Washington set the precedent by declining to have his portrait struck on a silver dollar at the outset of the Republic because he correctly believed that would be too monarchical and not fitting for a republic.
Yeah, well, if they are going to have a $250 bill, I think given the times in which we live, Elbridge Gerry would be, a better person to put on a $250 bill, the guy who invented the gerrymander. My candidate for jackassery is... This truly, I think, disgusting cage fight that Donald Trump is going to stage on the White House grounds, a UFC Ultimate Fighting Championship, thousands of spectators, soldiers being obliged to show up in uniform. This is barbaric. And it is, you know, it's just another example of the dignity of the office being trampled. Now, there have been fisticuffs in the White House before. Teddy Roosevelt, for exercise purposes, would challenge young Marine captains to fistfights, boxing. And as a result, he had one of his eyes basically blinded. But, you know, that was exercise, and he wasn't doing it in public, which he would have thought was gross. So I find that disgusting. I do, since, as you know, I am waging this campaign to cheer you up as in this dark period in our country's history. I want to give a Profiles in Courage Award to Congressman Jake Auchincloss. So he's a Democratic representative from Massachusetts. And he said that the Totenkopf tattoo, so that's the death's head insignia, which was a Nazi symbol that Graham Plattner had tattooed on his chest, which he kept there for quite a while, by the way, for years. He had it covered up later when he realized it might be a political liability, is disqualifying. And I give him a lot of credit for that because, you know, the frequently the test of courage for a politician is going against your own tribe. I mean, it's a test of courage for anybody. And Auchincloss met that challenge. And besides that, I happen to think Plattner's a pretty odious character who's now complaining about having been sent to go off and fight in Iraq, even though he was in the military for 8 years, going from the Marines to the Army National Guard, and then volunteering to serve in the successor to Blackwater in Afghanistan so he could go one more time. But quite apart from that, I mean, the central issue is that Totenkopf tattoo plus other things. And good on Jake Auchincloss for saying, no, this guy's not, is should be disqualified from being a Democratic representative from any state, including Maine.
Yeah, I've had actually a couple of opportunities to be in some sessions with Representative Auchincloss, and although he's far more liberal than I am, and I don't agree with him on, I'm sure, a whole raft of issues, I have found him very thoughtful, very, very intelligent, and I wish we had more of, you know, legislators in the Congress, you know, like him, for the reasons you've mentioned, but others as well. Okay, well, you know, the president had a meeting this afternoon. We're recording on Friday. It was a meeting that was meant to be the decision meeting on the MOU with Iran that will end the shutdown slash blockade of the Strait of Hormuz and extend the ceasefire by 60 days and presumably pave the way for negotiations that will provide for the ultimate resolution of the Iran nuclear issue. Apparently, it met for 2 hours, but, you know, no white smoke. President still, despite having advertised this as a decision meeting, still has not made a decision and continues to say that they're negotiating effectively and they're exchanging documents and language back and forth, but he is not yet ready to sign off on this. By the way, on the Iranian side, the Supreme Leader, Mujtaba Khamenei, has also not signed off on it, apparently, according to Iranian sources. So what do you make of all this, Elliot? Is this just a kind of kabuki between both sides that neither side wants to sign off until they're absolutely sure that the other signs off? Is it Alphonse and Gaston, or what's going on?
So, of course, my reading of it is this proves that I was right all along in a couple of ways. First, that the correct bet is not taco, but tacos. Trump always chickens out sometimes. I mean, I think what's interesting here is he's not chickened out. And it's interesting. A lot of the commentary has, I think, portrayed this as, you know, this is a defeat. He's, you know, Trump is in a terrible predicament from it's a quagmire. I've wrote an article recently about that we can discuss. I think there's certain deals he's not willing to make. I think what's happening is the interlocutors that they have going, particularly on the American side, would like, some sort of deal or some sort of way to postpone it. But the differences are so profound and so deep between two sides which don't understand each other and have totally incompatible views of who has the upper hand. It would be amazing if you did get anything other than some sort of temporary extension of a ceasefire. So I can't say I'm very surprised by this. I mean, I'm prepared. I can imagine anything happen, but it's one of the reasons, as you know, why I think most of the denunciations on this score of Trump, not on other scores, but on this score, are premature, is because nothing's happened. He hasn't made a decision. He has not been nearly as weak-willed as people thought he might be. And the two sides are profoundly far apart. And I don't know about you, but I don't see a compromise here that that can bring this thing to an end. I think the Iranians think they have us by the throat, and I think Trump thinks he has them by the throat. I don't see that changing. What about you?
That's true, but I guess I have a slightly different sense of the dynamic here, which is that the president keeps alternating between blood-curdling threats. You know, either they're going to make a deal, or we're going to destroy their whole civilization. You know, or you know, the guy next to me, Pete Hegseth, he'll take care of it. You know, but the president has been clearly, I mean, after 40 days of strikes, we've now had more ceasefire than we've had kinetic military activity. And he's clearly signaling, whether he intends it or not, to the Iranians by these constant postponements, that he does not want to go back to kinetic military activity. And the result, I think, is that he's actually hardened their position. I think their position has gotten harder. To your point, I think they think they're winning because they've said this. I mean, they've said that, we've discovered that something that we thought might be a lever for us, we've now proven that it is, and it's the economic equivalent of an atomic bomb. So we don't need the atomic bomb now. We have potentially this control over the strait. That is, of course, one of the issues they're wrestling about. The U.S. rightly is saying we're not going to, tolerate any tolls. But I have a very bad feeling that when this is all over, you're going to see a lot of environmental fees being charged by Oman and, Iran to ships transiting the strait, which, it's a toll by any other name, but it's also fits under certain, maritime law categories, for protect against environmental damage, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's very hard for him right now to kind of get out of all this.
No, look, I think he clearly found himself in a situation he didn't expect. I mean, I think they expected this to be a very swift operation and for the other side either to cave or the regime to collapse, and that didn't happen. I think you're right. He would like for this to be over, but he may not be nearly as desperate as people think he is. And even if he's mishandled the negotiations, which I completely accept, I don't think he wants to be the president who lets the nuclear program get away. And I don't think he wants to be the president that really lets them charge tolls on the Straits of Hormuz. And above all, he does not want to be humiliated by these people. I mean, this is, I think part of the key of his personality, and I think it does go to the malignant narcissism of Donald Trump, is he, the one thing he couldn't bear would be the idea of people laughing at him. That did apparently play some sort of role in the final decision to launch with Maduro. And like I said, I think for the rest, unfortunately, we just have to wait. I mean, this is too unpredictable. One more thing. He did say one interesting thing this week. He said, "I don't care about the midterms." Now, that may have been a lie, but I don't think it was entirely a lie. This is a very selfish man. He doesn't care if his party gets crushed so long as they they will probably impeach him. But so long as they can't remove him from office, I don't think he cares.
No, I think there's...
I really don't think he cares.
Yeah, I think there's a level of truth. I mean, it's... He cares and he doesn't care. I mean, I think it's, you know, he's trying to turn, you know, the fact... I think he's sort of accepted the fact they're going to lose the House. I mean, it would be completely contrary to all previous, you know, historical experience of off year elections for them not to lose the House, given the, you know, circumstances we have now. So I think in one sense, kind of it's a sunk cost for him. He's written it off, and he's trying to turn it into a virtue by saying, look, I'm not allowing political considerations to, you know, to affect my judgment here. It's only the national interest I care about. Which again is sort of a half truth. You know, I mean, I don't doubt that at some level he does care, as you say, about, you know, not being the president who let them get a nuclear weapon, or he says that repeatedly, or charge the tolls. Although one does not get the sense that anybody in this administration has thought through sort of, you know, what the, you know, follow on to all this is going to look like. Because let's say, as part of this MOU, that Iran says, we will not charge tolls. You know, there's definitely going to be a understood or implied for now. Because as soon as the U.S. Navy starts to vacate the, you know, region, and we go back to a, you know, a more normal status quo antebellum force posture, they'll be able to, you know, impose fees, whatever. And what are we going to do about it? We're going to go back and do this all over again? I think more likely we'll end up going to having a very large presence in the region, much not as big as what we have now, but much larger than what we had on February 28th. And it's going to be a permanent condition, which is going to have create problems for us elsewhere in the world because of the inability to move forces.
I mean, as I think I said to you earlier, you know, it reminds me of your old boss, Don Rumsfeld's definition of low density, high demand assets means we didn't buy enough. I mean, I always thought it was a crazy idea to think that we could abandon the Middle East, which administrations have wanted to do for a while. You know, it was a reasonable investment of American military power to be there, and it still is. We should probably move on a little bit. I will briefly flog a piece that I wrote in The Atlantic, which was basically an extended kvetch about the way people comment on this war. And I just want to highlight one thing, one word which particularly set me off, which I went after, which is the use of the word quagmire, which, you know, and in fact, I think I noticed on the Foreign Affairs website one day when, you know, I get the daily update, they had two articles which had the word quagmire in the title. And the reason why I object to it is it just seems to me there's an awful lot of simplistic thinking about this war. And it's in part because of the demands of 24/7 commentary. So, for example, you know, you don't have people taking into account the fact that, well, you know, in some ways, this is not an independent war. This is a campaign in the course of a war that's been going on for five decades, or nearly five decades, which has been costing American lives since the very beginning, let us remember. Or, you know, the idea of quagmire that this is like Vietnam or, in a different way, Iraq, which just isn't true. I mean, we're not committed to some vast insurgency campaign. You're talking about ships and airplanes in an all-volunteer force being stationed in the Persian Gulf. Well, we've had that before. And I just think there's a lot of slovenly thinking about it. And that none of that is to say that I think these guys have made the right strategic judgments. Far from it. I agree with you. I don't think they've thought through much at all. But I do think it doesn't excuse the critics, you know, who really do owe it to all of us to, you know, be careful and analytic about what it is that they're actually saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that, any net assessment of where we are is going to have to depend on, you know, what, you know, what's in the MOU, what's not in the MOU, what comes next in the 30 or 60 days of negotiations. So very, very early on. Let's, you know, we talked last week a little bit about Russia and Ukraine, but, you know, that's it's back again. And a lot of stuff's going on. The Russians, number one, had a drone that hit an apartment building in Romania. I mean, it doesn't appear to have been an intentional strike, but still, you know, a reminder of the fact that, you know, this is a major, the biggest war in Europe since 1945, and there's always the potential for escalation. The Russians had one of the largest strikes on Ukraine this week, including with the Oreshnik, which is a dual-capable medium-range or intermediate-range ballistic missile, which was, in fact, it was this missile that was the one of the occasions for Trump to get out of the INF Treaty in the first term. And it was also coincident with a major Russian nuclear exercise that involved all elements of their nuclear triad, which is to say long-range aviation, bombers, intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine, ballistic missile submarines, and test firing some ballistic submarine ballistic missiles, and involved the senior leadership, including Putin. And normally this exercise is towards the end of the year annually, but they did this now while they were also firing this dual-capable missile. And it is obviously intended as a signal to the U.S., to Europeans, that Russia maintains the, you know, ability to escalate this in very serious ways if it chooses to do so.
Yeah, but here's the thing that strikes me about that. I don't think anybody really noticed. You know, it didn't attract any press commentary that I saw. If governments were getting rattled, I didn't detect a whole lot of that. I mean, this is part of the pattern. When the Russians are under pressure, they, you know, begin rattling the nuclear saber. I've begun to wonder if when they do this kind of thing, and particularly with Putin playing a prominent role, this is being done as much for a domestic audience as for an international one. You know, we usually interpret these things as signals to us or to the Europeans, don't push us too far, and so on. What I can imagine this is this is a way of Putin showing that he's a tough guy who's in charge, and this is a way of signaling to Russian elites, you know, we are still a big, strong, enormously powerful country at a time when they're losing.
I agree. I think that's certainly part of this. I also think it's a very traditional Russian thing. And, you know, when you appear weak to outsiders, particularly the West, you know, you resort to this kind of threat and bluster. So it's not, and none of it's particularly surprising, honestly.
Yeah. Speaking of nuclear matters, I do want to call people's attention to a monograph you just published at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments on nuclear command and control. You want to give people some of the highlights of that?
Yeah, the thumbnail is, you know, people have talked about the so-called three-body problem, the challenge of the United States for the first time in its history having to deter potentially two nuclear peers, and people trying to figure out how do we, you know, do that. I mean, and there's, you know, a lot of thinking going on at Stratcom and elsewhere about how do we deal with this problem. I don't think it means we have to match both Russia and China warhead for warhead, but we do have to probably adjust our numbers a little bit. But the point I make in this monograph is that when you look at the modernization that Russia and China have done, both of them have begun to invest in a lot of capabilities that could be used. Doesn't mean they will be used, but could be used in a decapitation strike against U.S. nuclear command and control, which is aging out and is due for modernization, just as the three legs of our nuclear triad, you know, bombers, ICBMs, and SLBMs are due as well. And, you know, a decapitation strike, as the late John Steinbrenner wrote some years ago, 40 years ago, was the only really viable kind of theory of victory in nuclear war, right? Which is you decapitate the adversary from the get-go and they can't respond. And nobody else has ever figured out how you ever wage a nuclear war and actually have a winner come out of it. So what I've done is looked at basically some of these things that the Russians and Chinese have invested in. I mean, one of the things that just today in Reuters has a big story on what the Chinese are building out near their missile silos, which is a gigantic complex, which is, you know, some of the buildings were reported by the Financial Times a year ago, and our former colleague in government, Dennis Wilder, who was the NIO for China when you and I were in government, was quoted by the FT as saying, what they're building is something that's like, I think, five times the size of the Pentagon. Underground, it would be perfect for, you know, nuclear war fighting. And what that made me do was go back and look at the history of how we responded to threats of nuclear decapitation in the Cold War, because it was a persistent concern. When you look at the history of NC3, what you see is that people didn't pay very much attention to it until some crisis, like the Cuban Missile Crisis, forced them to. That technology frequently would outstrip their efforts to build things that could withstand the weaponry that our adversaries were developing. So, for instance, when the Russians started to develop MIRV'd ICBMs, multiple warheads on big missiles, that created a whole set of problems, which in the Carter administration, actually, is Big Brzezinski and Bill Odom put a lot of work into to try and deal with and modernize. And that work was picked up by the Reagan administration as well. And it involved the presidents, both Carter and Reagan, being involved in nuclear exercises the way Putin just was. And my conclusion from all this is, number one, we have to modernize all the early warning satellites, modernize the SAOC, which is the aircraft, survivable aircraft for the president to leave town in an emergency, the Navy's TACMO aircraft, which are meant to give us the ability to communicate with our nuclear submarines. This is something we need to do, and we need to be seen to be doing it. We need to be refreshing our continuity of government, continuity of operations, exercises, get the senior leadership of the U.S. government involved in these so they understand what would be required of them in an actual crisis. And part of that is a deterrent signal to the adversaries, which is not to think that because you're developing all of these capabilities that you actually want to take a roll of the dice in this kind of thing.
I have to say, one of the things that that I find concerning is that this administration will, in a certain way, discredit the kind of spending that you need to be able to do that. I mean, I think it's not as though the other side then says, look, you know, you're basically right that we do have to spend a lot of money on defense. We just think that you're doing it in a somewhat misguided way. It's a more blanket kind of denunciation, which I think we're certainly seeing at the Iran war, but, you know, it's even more dangerous in certain ways with nuclear issues.
Unfortunately, we've lost Elliot due to technical difficulties up at Basin Harbor in Vermont on the shores of Lake Champlain. But because we do extensive preparations for Shield of the Republic, we don't want our viewers and listeners to be without the insights that Elliot and I hope we could provide. So let me just briefly go through a couple of the other subjects that, had Elliot been able to stay with us, we would have covered. First, the outbreak of Ebola in a Democratic Republic of the Congo, and in particular, the news that Kenyan court, high court, has ruled that the U.S. government cannot use a facility in Kenya as a place to quarantine Americans who might have come into contact with Ebola. The reason we wanted to discuss this was that we've talked a lot about the destruction of the interagency process in national security affairs in the second Trump administration. And one of the things that has resulted from that has been, along with the destruction of USAID, has been a loss of the emergency epidemic and pandemic preparedness that the U.S. government had achieved before Trump came back into office. And to be fair, the Obama administration had done quite a good job of dealing with the Ebola outbreak back in 2014. A point that Elliot made was that this also betrays the lack of regard for partners and allies that this administration routinely demonstrates by just announcing things, assuming that allies or partners are going to go along with them without the normal consultations and checks that a regular diplomatic process would be. So we focus a lot on process and procedure. Sometimes it's not clear why this would matter to anybody who's listening to this podcast. In this instance, there's a dramatic danger of Ebola spreading in the world and potentially to the United States. So that was one subject that we were going to touch on. Another subject was John Cornyn's defeat in the primary in Texas. This is, I think, obviously Ken Paxton is unfit to hold office. Our colleagues on other Bulwark podcasts have gone into this in extensive detail, the apparent need for, as Tim Miller has put it, vice signaling to voters in order to get elected in a Republican primary, or as Thomas Massey said, that Republican voters want to elect the craziest son of a bitch in the race to office is clearly an example of that. But Elliot and I were concerned about it from the point of view that this was one of the more traditional, sober voices for conservative internationalist approach to global security affairs that is waning in the Republican Party, and Cornyn's loss is another nail in that coffin. And it is troublesome that, as Sarah Longwell has pointed out, you're beginning to see the rise in her focus groups of support, both in the Democratic and Republican sides of the aisle, for figures like Candace Owens, who represent what Sarah has, I think, aptly termed the America First, Israel Worst factions in both the far Republican right and the Democratic left. And Elliot was going to draw attention to Senator Chris Van Hollen's op-ed in New York Times. Chris Van Hollen being anti-Israel is nothing new. He's been a critic of Israel for a long time. But what appeared new to me, at least in that op-ed, was the kind of Stalinoid urge to purge people from the Democratic Party who don't agree with Van Hollen about Israel. And this, spirit of intolerance for political difference is, I think, a danger to our political system and to both political parties. It's a subject Elliot and I have touched on before, the need to police the extremes in both parties. This populism that Ken Paxton represents in the primary is also of a piece with what we're seeing more broadly globally, where we've seen a wave of European populism. I think people have taken comfort in the defeat of Viktor Orban by Peter Magyar, and we should all celebrate that. But if you look around the rest of Europe, the AfD in Germany, Marine Le Pen and her deputy Jordan Bardella, who seem to be on track to win the next election in France next year. We've seen this throughout Eastern Europe. This is, a very, very powerful political wave that those who support liberal democracy need to be concerned about. Finally, I think Elliot and I were going to return to the subject of Cuba, which we touched on last week, which was essentially the prospect that the administration might turn to Cuba now that the president was getting bored with Iran. Further developments, the Nimitz carrier strike group has arrived in the Caribbean, and that gives the administration more political military tools to increase the pressure on Cuba. The president was quoted as saying, other presidents have looked at this for 50, 60 years, and it looks like I'm going to be the one to actually do it, to take care of it, which I think is actually a view that he has more broadly of not just Venezuela, but of Iran and now of Cuba. The Cuban military is obviously no match for the U.S. military. There's a huge overmatch there. And the Cuban military, which once upon a time was a particularly troublesome force for the United States, with Cuban mercenaries operating in various African and other third world contingencies around the world, is now suffering from lack of spare parts, shortage of trained pilots, lack of air and missile defense. So it's no match, but it also is the case that a U.S. military intervention would then require some kind of plan for the day after. What would the United States do? And it does seem, Financial Times had a very good write-up of this week, does seem that the administration is just ratcheting up the pressure on Cuba in the hope that the regime will make a deal of some kind, kind of looking for Delcy Rodriguez again to negotiate with the administration. It seems to be Secretary Rubio's plan for Cuba. But there's a real danger. I mean, they're looking towards the summer when hot temperatures and lack of electricity will make people irritable and bring people out into the streets. But, you know, I'm old enough to remember the Mariel boat lift in the late 1970s. Humanitarian crises in Cuba tend to spill over into the United States. And there's every possibility this thing will go, no matter how the administration tries to manage it, terribly wrong. And that seems a typically kind of upbeat note on which to end a episode of Shield of the Republic. So thank you for bearing with us through our technical difficulties. We'll be back next week, hopefully, with Elliot not having Wi-Fi troubles.